From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. When President Reagan took office, he vowed swift and effective retribution against terrorists. In the 8 years since then, terrorists have killed more than 350 Americans. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we examine America's failed anti-terrorist policy with CBS Pentagon correspondent David Martin, co-author of the new book Best Laid Plans. Also today, the making of the baseball film Bull Durham. We hear part two of my conversation with the screenwriter and director Ron Shelton, who also played 5 years in the minor leagues. Michael Doucette and a couple of his friends from the Cajun band Beau Soleil are back for our weekly performance spot. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone profiles New York-based comic Angela Scott. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The hijacking of the Achille Lauro, the death in captivity of William Buckley, the bombing of Gaddafi's compound, trading arms for hostages. David Martin covered such recent terrorist and anti-terrorist attacks as the Pentagon correspondent for CBS TV News and as a former Newsweek reporter. Now he's had a chance to further investigate these incidents for his new book, The Best Laid Plans, the inside story of America's war against terrorism. The book uncovers new information about the Reagan administration's war against terrorism, including secret anti-terrorist schemes and cover-ups of bungled anti-terrorist attacks. The Best Laid Plans is co-authored with The Wall Street Journal's national security correspondent, John Walcott. It covers the period of 1980 through the end of 1987, in which 363 Americans died in terrorist incidents, most of them when a truck bomb crashed into Marine headquarters in Lebanon. I spoke to David Martin from WAMU in Washington, D.C. I asked him to elaborate on a statement he made in the beginning of his book, that tracking back over these terrorist events has been an exercise in humility, a revelation of how much he missed or got wrong the first time around.
Well, I think the 1986 raid on Libya would be a case in point. At the time, the Pentagon portrayed it as a flawless operation, and we reported it as such because we had Pentagon officials on camera saying that this was a flawless operation. When you get into the raid in detail, you find out that a whole lot went wrong with the raid, which we didn't know about at the time. I have to say, though, that it was the Air Force pilots themselves who told me all of these things that went wrong. So certainly the system eventually turned out to be honest about what went on. I think, though, at the time there was a perception within the government that you needed to portray this as a piece of clockwork magic that we could do again and again in an effort to convince Gaddafi that he should give up his terrorist ways. It turns out, for instance, that 9 planes were targeted against Gaddafi's headquarters. Only 2 of those 9 planes dropped their bombs, and both of them missed their target.
I want to get into that in a little more depth a little later on in the interview. Terrorism, I think, is an incredibly difficult subject as it's happening for a reporter to cover because of just the things that you've mentioned, that you're frequently not given accurate information. I think sometimes you're intentionally misled.
I think that's the case. I'll give you another case in point, which was the TWA 847 hijacking in June of 1985. At the beginning of that hijacking, which went on for 17 days, there were some news reports that the Delta Force, the team that does the rescue missions for the United States Army, was en route to the Mediterranean to position itself for a possible rescue mission if the hostage situation continued. And everybody within the Reagan administration got very upset about how irresponsible the press was in reporting these military movements, and they even claimed that the hijackers had heard this report and had moved the plane back to Beirut, where, of course, Delta could not get at it. We could never find any justification for that other than that claim. But then, at the end of the TWA 847 hijacking, one of the Reagan administration's strategies was to portray or create an atmosphere of military menace. to convince the people that were holding the hostages that something bad was about to happen and that we were about to take military action because we had passed the point where we were no longer going to sit still for this. And then, of course, the administration fell all over itself trying to get the press to report military movements of aircraft carriers and the like in the Mediterranean. At one point, the press is a great inconvenience to the administration in a terrorist incident, and then at another point, it is a great tool to be used by the administration. And I guess if you're a reporter, the only thing you can do is sort of keep your head down and just try to get whatever facts you have straight. And if you're being used at one point and probably hurting the cause at the other, you just sort of have to try and play it straight and go with what you know and sort of let these ulterior motives fall out of your mind.
Let's get to some of the findings that you report in your new book, Best Laid Plans. Mm-hmm. Now, after Reagan was inaugurated and the American hostages who were held in Iran came home, the president said, "Let terrorists beware that when the rules of international behavior are violated, our policy will be one of swift and effective retribution." Now, you report that a lot of high-placed people in the State Department were very sorry that the president made that statement. Why?
Well, they didn't know he was going to make it. The people that were in charge of counterterrorism policy in the State Department were totally blindsided by that statement. They didn't. They'd never seen those words before. And it turns out that those words were drafted by one guy named Ken Edelman, who later became the head of the Arms Control Agency in the Reagan administration. But he had been sent, as part of the Reagan transition team, he had been sent to West Germany to greet the hostages that were coming out of Iran. They stopped in West Germany for medical examination and treatment. And he came back to the White House after having seen the hostages, after having listened to some of their tales, and gave a report to the president and his top advisors. And in the course of that report, he said that one of the CIA officers in the group of hostages had been kept more or less in solitary confinement the whole time. And at one point, Reagan asked him if any of the women hostages had been mistreated. Ken Edelman said no, he had no evidence that any of those the women had been mistreated, but he could tell that he really had the president's attention, and he used that to propose making a strong statement about terrorism. So and the president endorsed that idea, so Edelman, who had no prior responsibility or experience in the field of terrorism, went back to his office at the State Department and drafted that phrase in the speech, which vowed swift and effective retribution, which I think would have to go down as in the category of famous last words of the Reagan administration.
Well, sure, the president said that before there was any kind of policy of what effective action would be or how they could possibly retaliate against terrorists. There was nothing to back it up.
There was nothing to back it up. And there still isn't, because swift and effective retribution is, in most cases, simply not possible.
Well, I want to talk with you about that raid against Libya in which Gaddafi's compound was bombed. Let me reintroduce you first. My guest is David Martin. He's the Pentagon correspondent for CBS News and co-author of the new book, Best Laid Plans, The Inside Story of America's War Against Terrorism. Okay, let's talk about this attack against Libya in 1986. Why was Gaddafi's compound chosen as the target? His wife and his children lived there. He had communications facilities there, security barracks. Why was that chosen as the target for the bombing raid?
Well, it was as close as you could come to finding the central location of Gaddafi's government, of the Gaddafi regime. It was his headquarters. The staff of his military had its offices there. He had his personal house there. He had the tent where he received visitors there. It was as close as you can come to finding the Libyan White House.
Now, you report that Oliver North wanted to try to arrange it so that Gaddafi would be killed during that retaliation.
That's right. Everybody hoped they'd get lucky and kill Gaddafi, because I think everybody looked at Libya and said, you know, that would be an entirely different country if Gaddafi wasn't there. And more than most countries, that leader is the cause of all our problems. So assassination is something that is prohibited by our law, but there's nothing that says you can't get lucky in a bombing raid. And what Oliver North wanted to do was increase the chances of getting lucky. He wanted to use Terry Wade, who had a track record of negotiating with the Libyans to get British citizens out of Libyan jails. He wanted Terry Wade to go to Tripoli and meet with Gaddafi on the night that the raid was scheduled. He would then terminate the meeting, which would presumably be held in the tent where Gaddafi received all visitors. He would terminate the meeting before the bomber struck. He would go back to his quarters and leave Gaddafi behind at ground zero. Everybody we talked to said that plan was shot down almost as soon as North proposed it, but it was proposed at a fairly high level within the Reagan administration, a group called the Crisis Pre-Planning Committee, which is a group of assistant secretaries of state, defense, etc. So it's a sort of one rung below the decision, the level at which the president makes decisions.
One of the amazing things about that plan was the idea that North was willing to use Terry Wade as an unknowing pawn in this game. Terry Wade, who had risked so much on behalf of hostages.
Well, when you think it through, it really is a fairly harebrained scheme, because although Wade was supposed to be unwitting, I don't know what he was supposed to think when you told him that no matter what you do, you better get out of there before midnight. I also don't know how they expected Wade, as a guest of Gaddafi, one of the most unpredictable rulers in the world, how they expected Wade to be able to set the time and place for this meeting. But anyway, that was North's idea. And then after the raid, when Gaddafi emerged shaken but still alive, North came up with another idea for getting him if there was a subsequent raid. And this time he was going to get a friendly foreign leader to place a phone call to Gaddafi, and then they were going to have the National Security Agency monitor the phone call and use that signal to pinpoint Gaddafi's location and then go after him.
Now, as I think you pointed out, that violates the president's executive order prohibiting assassination of foreign leaders. Is there any way that you think something like that could have been approved?
No, I don't think it was approved. I think at the political level in Washington, it was realized that although they sure did want to kill Gaddafi, you couldn't plan on it, because that would simply get you in so much trouble that whatever benefits the raid produced would be wiped out. At the Air Force level, the people that were actually dropping the bombs, I think they simply had the very realistic perception that you just simply can't plan on killing one person with a bomb dropped from a plane that's flying 600 miles an hour in the middle of the night.
Well, I want to get to another story in this bombing raid on Gaddafi's compound, another story that Oliver North is involved in. But first, we're going to have to take a short break. My guest is David Martin. He's the Pentagon correspondent for CBS News and co-author of the new book, Best Laid Plans, The Inside Story of America's War Against Terrorism. We'll be back in just a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
David Martin is my guest, Pentagon correspondent for CBS News and author of the new book, Best Laid Plans, about terrorism. And we're talking about the U.S. retaliation raid against Libya in 1986, in which Gaddafi's compound was bombed. Now, the way you tell it, Oliver North used someone from the NSC, the National Security Council, to convey disinformation to NBC, to tell them that the raid had been postponed.
No, to ABC.
To ABC, I'm sorry.
That's right. It's you've got to sort of go back and recreate the atmosphere at the time. Everybody was predicting this attack. And, of course, the element of surprise is everything in these operations. So, and as a matter of fact, some people were unwittingly predicting the attack accurately. I remember on Friday night, I was doing a piece for the evening news out of the Pentagon, and I was doing a live question and answer with Dan Rather, and he asked me, when do you think the raid is going to occur? And I said, well, I don't believe anything anybody tells me on that subject, but I don't think it's going to occur before Monday. And I said that because somebody had told me they were going home for the weekend, but they were coming in ready to work on Monday. That was the basis for my saying it. It was basically speculation. But that was heard by the fleet over in the Mediterranean, and they thought CBS had blown the raid, which wasn't the case. But that's the level of paranoia there was about this the actual time of the raid leaking out. And so North had one of his aides call a reporter for NBC, a very good reporter for ABC, a very good reporter for ABC, and give him false information, simply tell him that the raid had been called off because they didn't have enough aircraft carriers in the Mediterranean to launch it. And it was just a flat lie, and the person who actually made the phone call to the ABC reporter, a fellow named Jonathan Miller, did not know it was a lie. He was simply relaying what North had told him to relay. And then when he finally tumbled to the fact that he had been used as this unwitting disinformation agent, he protested to North, and North got angry with him and kicked him out of his office.
Just very briefly, as a reporter yourself, do you think that kind of disinformation is ever justified?
It's hard to justify lying. It just has so many downsides to it, not the least of which is just ruining government credibility. Forget the morality of it for a minute. I just think it's such a short-sighted tactic that in the long run does you nothing but damage. And the easy way to deal with it was simply to say nothing. But I think in any event, I would be amazed if any news organization, had it known the precise time of the raid, would have reported it. And I think any news organization would have done what NBC did, which when they had about as clear an indication that you could have that the thing was about to happen, and they held off.
I want to save some time at the end of our interview for your conclusions about terrorism and mm-hmm. what a government is and isn't capable of doing. But first, I want to get back to something that you said earlier on. You said that when you were covering this bombing raid, that you and all the reporters were led to believe by the government that things went exactly as planned, that there was pinpoint accuracy, and you later learned that that was really far from the truth.
Yeah.
What were some of the things that you learned after the fact about what went wrong strategically?
Well, let's just take the attempt to get Gaddafi's headquarters. Originally, they had planned to send 6 airplanes against Gaddafi's compound. At the 11th hour, they decided to increase that number of planes from 6 to 9 to increase the amount of damage they would do to Gaddafi's compound. That decision was protested by the pilots who were going to fly the mission because they argued that the extra 3 planes, number 7, 8, and 9, in the stream of planes going against Gaddafi's compound would no longer have any element of surprise. Gaddafi's compound was heavily defended, and it was a difficult target because it was in the middle of downtown Tripoli. There were a lot of apartment buildings around the periphery, a high likelihood of civilian casualties, a difficult target to pick out among all that downtown clutter. They didn't want to go after that target, and they most of all didn't want to send extra planes against that target. They were overruled. They saluted their orders, and they took off, and they sent 9 planes. Everything that went wrong on that raid happened with those 3 extra planes that were sent against the Gaddafi's compound. The 7th plane is the one that crashed in the water, and the 8th plane is the one that accidentally dropped its bombs in a civilian neighborhood, killing quite a few Libyan civilians who were course, totally innocent of all this. For days afterwards, Defense Secretary Weinberger denied that the civilian casualties had been caused by American bombs, and he kept raising the possibility that what had really caused that damage was Libyan anti-aircraft missiles falling back to Earth after they had missed their targets. Well, the fact is that the pilot of the plane which dropped those bombs in the wrong place knew instantly that he had made a mistake because he could see the target through an infrared camera. He reported it instantly. Basically, what you had was a cover-up of the fact that everybody knew we had accidentally dropped our bombs in the wrong place.
So to sum up, I mean, the U.S. attempt at swift and effective retribution against terrorism ended up being very bungled.
Well, I wouldn't say it was bungled. I would say it was the best that you could expect under the circumstances. Mm-hmm. The circumstances are that you're going there in the middle of the night, you're going 600 miles an hour at 200 feet off the ground, and it's just a darn difficult task to put a bomb on target. And the reason it was at night and the reason they were doing it that way is because one of the constraints they were operating under were don't get any planes shot down. Now, if you wanted to destroy Gaddafi's compound and you didn't worry too much about how many of your own planes got shot down, you didn't worry about how many civilian casualties you had in the neighborhood, I have no question that the U.S. Air Force could go in and just basically reduce the entire place to rubble. But this was military force being used for political purposes. And when you do that, you always put constraints on what the military people can do, and those constraints inevitably make it more difficult for them to do their job.
Let me get back to something you said earlier. You said that you found out a lot about this information by going directly to some of the pilots who flew the bombing raid. I'm actually kind of surprised that they spoke with you.
Well, they not only spoke with us, they were extraordinarily frank, and all of the information which I've just related to you comes...
Why do you think they were frank?
I think because they felt basically what I just said, that they did the best job possible under the circumstances, and so they had nothing to hide. And so they simply told me in a very honest and straightforward way what had happened. And the only condition that was imposed was that I would not use their real name in the book because they are still worried that if Gaddafi knew their name, rank, and serial number, he might try and retaliate against them.
David Martin is my guest, Pentagon correspondent for CBS News and author of a new book about terrorism called Best Laid Plans. Let's get to some of the conclusions that you've reached about the United States' attempts to stop terrorism. You think that our ability to militarily react against terrorism and to know more about it from intelligence, that those abilities aren't going to get a lot better than they've been so far.
No, I think that if you go around railing against military incompetence and intelligence failures, nothing's ever going to get any better. What you have to do is develop a policy against terrorism that can operate within what you can reasonably expect military force and espionage to accomplish for you. And military force is not going to kill many terrorists. So far as is known, not a single terrorist was killed in the raid on Libya. And intelligence is almost never going to get you the date and time of the next terrorist attack. And if you sit around waiting for intelligence to come up with that kind of information, you're going to sit around waiting for the bombs to go off because it's just not going to give you that kind of information.
So you'd like to see the United States bring terrorists to court and, you know, prosecute them and punish them under the laws that are now on the books, the anti-terrorist laws. How do you do that? I mean, how do you find out where they are? How do you get them to the United States?
We've done it in a couple cases. There's a fellow in jail here in Washington named Fawaz Yunus who was involved in the kidnapping of a Jordanian airliner, which occurred just days before the TWA 847 hijacking, and there were two American citizens on board that plane. He was lured onto a yacht in the Mediterranean with promises of women and drugs, and he was arrested by the FBI, and he's in jail now. There's a lot of legal back and forth over whether his confession was properly taken, and it may well be that we never get a successful prosecution. But you got a guy, a terrorist, in the slammer right now, and that's better than we usually do.
There was a CIA plan which never got enacted to kidnap terrorists and bring them back to the United States courts. Would you support something like that?
Well, kidnap is such a pejorative word. I mean, if you can get the guy someplace outside of Lebanon and you can get the French to arrest him and turn him over to us or some other country, the Germans, wherever he happens to light in Europe, if you can get them to arrest him and then turn him over to us, I'm all for that. I mean, I think that is what the law is all about. And the law does one other thing. If it treats these terrorists for what they are, which is criminals. Terrorism is a threat to law and order. It's not a threat to national security. You take the most horrendous terrorist attack of the Reagan administration, maybe which was the bombing of the Marines in Beirut in October of 1983, 241 Americans killed in an instant. That was about as bad as you could possibly get in terms of a terrorist attack. It was an awful, awful tragedy, but it did not affect our national security. And we have since pulled out of Lebanon, and we are still a happy and secure nation. Terrorism is not a threat to your national security. It's a threat to law and order, and you ought to go after these guys the same way you go after other threats to law and order, which is with your law enforcement.
I'm interested in the kind of soul-searching you've been doing while writing this book. Is there anything that you plan on doing differently as a reporter now after having written this book?
Well, I guess, you know, one thing is you always, every time you go through one of these exercises where you circle back over events you've covered before, I mean, it's not unique to terrorism that you realize that you only got a small portion of the story the first time around.
Right.
I mean, that's just a limitation of daily journalism, and that's why you have all these other forms of journalism, such as books. So obviously, when you go through an exercise like this, you tell yourself, well, next time I'm going to be more careful and more thorough. But there are only 24 hours in a day, and chances are you probably won't do any better the next time around. I think probably the thing I have learned the most is not to put very much credence in claims of military perfection, but by the same token, not to expect it from an operation, and not to be unduly critical of an operation when you learn about this and that snafu, because as the title of our book, Best Laid Plans, implies, things always go wrong.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for being with us.
Sure thing.
My guest has been David Martin. He's the Pentagon correspondent for CBS News and co-author of the new book, Best Laid Plans, The Inside Story of America's War Against Terrorism. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with folk singer Dave Van Ronk. He's considered a founding father of both the blues and ragtime guitar revivals. He'll bring his guitar and play a few songs. I hope you can join us.
Another damn day, I take it away. I gotta make my gig on time. Flailing guitar, being a star, scuffling for nickels and dimes. Silly damn grind out of my mind.
Crazy. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Ron Shelton played minor league baseball for 5 years before hanging up the spikes and trying his hand at making movies. On the last Fresh Air, Shelton talked about his days in the minors. Today, Shelton tells us about writing and directing his new film, Bull Durham. Also, more Cajun music in our weekly performance spot with some members of the band Beausoleil. And critic at large Laurie Stone introduces us to comic Angela Scott. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. In the Israeli-occupied West Bank, the cities of Nablus and Hebron are under curfew tonight following violence between Palestinians and Jewish settlers. NPR's John Hockenberry reports.
At midday in both cities, violence broke out in the central districts. In Nablus, a man and a woman settler opened fire on a crowd with automatic weapons. The army moved in and imposed a curfew. The army said the settlers were provoked by stone-throwing Arabs. Arab eyewitnesses said that there was no stone throwing until after the settlers opened fire. At least 13 people were injured, according to Arab and Army reports, including 2 8-year-olds. In Hebron, a Jewish settler was stabbed in the main market. The settler opened fire with a revolver and injured his assailant after a chase. A riot ensued and the army moved in. The settler was hospitalized in serious condition. A group of armed settlers from Kiryat Arba, where the stabbed man was a resident, gathered at Israel's Hadassah Hospital, where the man was being treated, and blamed the attack on the United States for pressuring Israel against taking harsh steps against Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. I'm John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
In the first known fallout abroad from the U.S. investigation of alleged fraud and bribery in defense contracting, Switzerland has asked the Pentagon and two rival U.S. aircraft builders for information about allegations of corruption in defense procurement. The Swiss government, which is planning a $2 billion fighter purchase, immediately contacted the U.S. Department and the companies involved and requested additional information after the McDonnell Douglas FA-18 aircraft was named in connection with that probe. McDonnell Douglas is competing against General Dynamics to sell about 40 strike aircraft to Switzerland. By a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court ruled today that a school district may charge poor children for school bus service. NPR's Nina Totenberg has details.
Sarita Cattermas is a Dickinson, North Dakota school child. Her family's income is at the poverty level. She lives 16 miles from school, and bus transportation is provided for school children in this sparsely populated area of North Dakota. Even though most such areas in the state are required to provide free school bus transportation to school children, Dickinson does not provide free service. Sarita's family was charged $97 a year for the service. They fell behind in their payments and eventually sued the school system, claiming that Sarita's constitutional rights to equal protection of the laws were violated by the bus charge. Today, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, ruled against the Cattermas family. Writing for the court, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said that laws like this one that have a different effect on the wealthy and the poor are permissible as long as they are not arbitrary. And, said Justice O'Connor, there is no fundamental right to an education under the Constitution. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Japan said today it's resuming ties with the government of Panama. Lucy Kraft reports from Tokyo.
A top official with the Japanese Foreign Ministry announced Japan would break with Washington and give its backing to the government of military strongman Manuel Antonio Noriega. Japan had stopped contact in February, but wanted to show its support to the government led by Noriega in March. Now that several European and Latin American governments have recognized the government headed by President Manuel Solis Palma, the Japanese government said it felt the time was right to follow suit. Japan is Panama's second largest trading partner. Last year, Japanese investments were worth almost $9 billion. The decision was made known to the government of Panama yesterday when Japan's ambassador visited the foreign ministry in Panama City. For National Public Radio, this is Lucy Kraft in Tokyo.
Pope John Paul II visited the site of a Nazi death camp in Austria today and condemned Nazism as lunatic ideology. Upon his arrival, six American Jews scuffled with police during their protest against the Pope's meeting yesterday with Austrian President Kurt Waldheim, accused of complicity in Nazi war crimes. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Three members of the Cajun dance band Beau Soleil are back with us. Here's fiddler and vocalist Michael Doucette to introduce the first tune.
We play traditional music, but in order to keep our tradition alive, we have to put new things into it. So this is a song we wrote years ago called Take It To Me, Dimanche Après-Midi, sort of in franglais. And what it roughly translates is having a sort of a lazy afternoon and being close to the one you want to be with. All right, well, now we're going to go out with something sort of modern, traditional Cajun music from the 60s.
Un, deux, un, deux, trois, quatre.
to thank the members of the Cajun band Beau Soleil for joining us these past 4 weeks. Michael Doucette on fiddle and vocals, David Doucette on guitar and vocals, and Jimmy Bro on accordion. This is Fresh Air. Ron Shelton wrote and directed the new hit film Bull Durham about minor league baseball. Although Shelton spent 5 years in the minors, he says the film isn't autobiographical. After leaving baseball in 1971, Shelton studied sculpture, painted houses, and later turned to screenwriting. On the last Fresh Air, Shelton told us about his life as a ball player. Today we discuss making his directing debut on Bull Durham. I asked him how important it was to accurately capture the details of the game.
It was critical to me because the story only works because the world surrounding the story, I think, is evocative. Professional sports is largely played in backwaters and under dim lights with very few people in the stands. What we see on television and the million-dollar athletes are the exception to the rule. Most people are more familiar with the Durhams of the world and the Fresnos and the Dubuques and all the athletes struggling in places like that. So it was very important to me to try to get the smell of the place right. I have great affection for those towns. They're working class towns, and I sort of approach all this from a working class bias. And so I tried to pay great attention to the detail, the details on the field, the details in the bus, the details in the bar, in the locker room, and how a player held the bat were very important to me, and I spent a crazy amount of time trying to get them right. Not so you noticed them, but so you felt them.
Mm-hmm. Did you look for actors who you knew could bat or pitch convincingly?
Yeah, every actor that was hired had to then go down to Durham and pass a one-week baseball trial.
Did you administer this trial yourself?
Well, I had a couple of professional coaches running the players and the athletes in very strict workouts. And in the case of Kevin Costner, he actually voluntarily went to a batting cage when we first met and hit about 50 baseballs, right-handed and left-handed, to show me he could hit. And also because he didn't want to get into the movie if he didn't think he could play well enough. In the case of Tim Robbins, who has a wonderful performance as a young, out-of-control kid, he went out into the parking lot at Columbia and pitched several balls that went way over everybody's head, and I thought he was perfect. So, and we had 15 professional athletes who were on the team who were actual minor leaguers, and a couple of our actors were former minor leaguers.
What are some of the problems you run into when you're shooting a baseball scene, and say it's a scene where there has to be a home run? Do you have to keep shooting it until the actor actually hits that home run?
It's a nightmare. In the case of home runs, it's easy because there's no camera angle or lens that actually shows the ball go out of the park. It just has to look like it goes out. In the case, a couple of times, Kevin actually hit balls out of the park, but the camera doesn't show it. The more difficult thing, it was very funny because the classic baseball manager's nightmare is getting his pitcher to throw strikes, and it became the director's nightmare because several times I wanted Tim Robbins to throw the ball over the plate or throw a curveball over the plate, and it would take an inordinate amount of time trying to get him to hit the target. So I sort of felt like a manager out there as much as a director.
What kind of advice did you give Tim Robbins, who was playing the pitcher?
Well, I tried everything that a manager would try. I kicked dirt in his shoes. I treated him like a little kid. I stroked him. I built up his ego. I yelled at him. I stomped at him. I fined him. You do all the stuff. You have
fined
to do.
Him? You didn't really fine him?
You'd throw a fit in front of everybody. You try everything. You try everything. And Tim was wonderful and willing. But the more I'd get him to think about it, sometimes the less accurate he'd be, and I'd be violating my primary rule that you shouldn't think because it'll hurt the ball club. So, I made all the mistakes that any manager or baseball player would make.
I have to ask you about the character that Susan Sarandon plays. She plays a woman who has basically made her home into a baseball shrine, and every season, she takes one of the players. She chooses one of the players to become both her lover, and also she will be their mentor and kind of coach them in the ways of baseball and prepare them. And I'll tell you the truth. It struck me as a real male fantasy of a woman. someone who was well-read, knew a lot about baseball, and used all of this just to kind of help her man, both in terms of his sport and in bed.
These are the ground rules. I hook up with one guy a season. Usually takes me a couple weeks to pick the guy. It's kind of my own spring training. And, well, you two are the most promising prospects of the season so far. So I just thought we should kind of get to know each other.
Time out. Why do you get to choose? I mean, why don't I get to choose? Why doesn't he get to choose?
Well, actually, nobody on this planet ever really chooses each other. I mean, it's all a question of quantum physics, molecular attraction, and timing. I mean, there are laws we don't understand that bring us together and tear us apart.
So is somebody going to go to bed with somebody or what?
Honey, you are a regular nuclear meltdown. You better cool off.
Well, I don't think that's entirely accurate, though. Maybe Susan Sarandon's a male fantasy for most of us. Annie's character is a little more complicated than that, at least I intended it to be. She's a self-invented character. Her flamboyance and her theatricality are her own invention. She's covering the fact that, she is stuck in Durham teaching junior college English, and because she has an enormous ego and great pride and great inventiveness and the kind of cosmic creativity, she has covered for herself, covers a lot of her insecurities. And the way that Crash Davis also does it, he has a lot of bluster and bravado, and the whole movie is getting these two people who have invented their own theatrical covers to start to let down for each other. In the end of the movie, they're both sitting like little kids on a porch swing, and there's no facades left. So there may be a bit of male fantasy in her, but I think we've all known women like Annie, and they hang around art departments and libraries and theater in small towns, and I think they're kind of a part Earth Mother and part witch and part cosmic, I don't even know what. I'm fascinated by them. I've seen a lot of Annies, so I don't know if I should embrace the fact that she's a male fantasy or get defensive and say she isn't, except to say I've known women like Annie, and a lot of people I know have known women like Annie. I think the conceit is maybe putting her in the ball field, making her the high priestess of baseball.
I have read several articles about how baseball movies aren't usually successful, although Bull Durham seems to be very successful so far at the box office. Is this something you had to think about when you were writing the movie?
It seems like half of my scripts are on subjects that are cursed. So if it's not baseball, it's something political. So I just basically ignore that.
Well, that's interesting you should mention that, because one of your earlier screenplays, Under Fire, was set in Nicaragua. And I was wondering if you went through a period where people thought that maybe you were a little too politically to the left to write their next screenplay.
They don't care if you're a fascist or a Marxist, as long as you make money for them. I'm
right,
serious about
right.
that. And now, I'm not commenting on that. That doesn't need commenting on. But if Under Fire had been... The fact that it was a critical success meant nothing. If it had been a box office success, suddenly there would have been more Ferrari-driving Marxists in Hollywood than you've ever seen in your life, and there would have been 20 movies saying about supporting popular leftist causes around the world.
I have one last question for you. The movie is about a team called the Durham Bulls. Why did you name it Bull Durham?
Well, Bull Durham is probably the most famous American chewing tobacco and rolling tobacco, and it was, you know, in the 1800s and early part of the 20th century, it was the dominant name in the American landscape, like meal pouch tobacco. And I thought it, Bull Durham had a kind of a rural southern tobacco generic feel and flavor to it that and maybe a tiny sexual overtone, and identifying Durham as the city of location. All of those things, I thought, gave it a kind of a strong, evocative title. However, enough people have asked that question that maybe we were wrong.
Well, that doesn't seem to be hurting very much.
After you saw the movie, did the title make any more sense to you, or did it still make no sense, or had you not heard of the chewing tobacco?
Yeah, I think I maybe hadn't heard of the chewing tobacco, so it still confused me.
Well, that's why I don't make my living writing titles.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Ron Shelton spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. Shelton wrote and directed Bull Durham. It stars Susan Sarandon and Kevin Costner.
What do you believe in then?
Well, I believe in the soul. The small of a woman's back, the hanging curveball, high fiber, good scotch, that the novels of Susan Sontag are self-indulgent, overrated crap. I believe Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. I believe there ought to be a constitutional amendment outlawing AstroTurf and the designated hitter. I believe in the sweet spot, softcore pornography, opening your presents Christmas morning rather than Christmas Eve, and I believe in long, slow, deep, soft, wet kisses that last 3 days.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What do you have for us?
Well, we're following events on the West Bank, where today there was more violence between Palestinians and not Israeli soldiers at this point, but Jewish settlers. Also, another story on Pope John Paul II's trip to Austria. We have a report from John Idstey on the role of defense consultants and how that role has grown over the years, and from Ann Cooper on preparations in Moscow for the Special Soviet Party Congress. Also, a story about Paul de Man, a leading light of the literary theory of deconstruction before his death, who was recently discovered to have been a Nazi collaborator in wartime Belgium.
Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic at large Laurie Stone looks at the up-and-coming career of black stand-up comic Angela Scott.
I first saw comedian Angela Scott a year and a half ago, and she did a funny riff about moving to Concord, Massachusetts as a kid. See any black people there? No? That's right, we're here now. She said girls would come up and say, "Oh, hi." Move. And she put a taut rap on male posturing, describing the way men touch themselves, then want to shake hands with you. But her confidence slipped when she wasn't squarely inside race and sex. She tried too hard to please, as if she felt she needed to butter in order to burn, as if she were apologizing for the best parts of herself. Her nervousness was understandable. As a black woman in comedy, she had scant forebears and few peers. But a couple of weeks ago, I caught her at another club, and her manner was so cocky and cool, her material registered funnier. An apartment becomes available in her building. She wants it for a friend, but the landlord says no. So when white gentry arrive, she's out on the landing in slippers with a beer can in her hand. "Leroy, don't start no stuff. You put that knife down. Come on out here, kids, all 20 of you." Her finale is a sultry ode to young flesh, she says. The nice thing about a 20-year-old son who's 6'4" and gorgeous is the young, healthy friends who come by. Scott and I had lunch a few days later, and she talked about her life. Her mother encouraged her, but there was pain. The Concord move was real and even more estranging than she makes it sound. She was also the first brown-skinned child on her mother's side, the side she grew up around, and relatives told her she was ugly. Her aunt used to lock her in a bedroom when friends came. Her grandfather called her monkey until she was 17. Scott went to college in Cambridge, and when she saw white police shooting at black kids in Roxbury, the rage she'd sat on for a lifetime came flooding up. She became a Black Panther, got arrested, and then expelled. There were men and babies, son Peter and Erica, 17. A move to Manhattan in the early 70s, and soon after acting at the Negro Ensemble Actors Workshop, where she met Robert Townsend. They stayed friends, and now he encourages her to shut off the censors in her head. She told me, I want to bring out all that stuff about race, hair and skin and bodies, but I get afraid I won't be able to control it. When Scott cooks, that's exactly what she's able to do. She riffs on her grandfather's nickname for her in her act. A date would come to the door and he'd yell, "Monkey, swing on out here, girl." It's a dangerous moment. What if the audience gets off on her grandfather's color prejudice, his cruelty? But Scott nets the laughs she wants, laughs that sympathize with the powerlessness of childhood and see the brutality of authority figures. She's in control, because standing on stage as the lean, soignée woman she's become, most of the pain is past, and so much vengeful gratification is being reaped. Scott may not be ready to headline, but few performers have her gut-felt integrity about race and sex, or her desire to keep mining for healing menace. Whether or not she's writing or performing it, she always wears it. She never goes anywhere without her black baby pin, a gift from Patrick Kelly, the dress designer who makes them. My mother would say, "Take that thing off." She'd think it was racist. Angela shakes her head. It's not. It's all those gorgeous chocolate women who used to dance at the Cotton Club. And it's Scott.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Comic Will Durst is so into political humor, he even tried running for office just to get closer to the action. On the next Fresh Air, Durst talks with us about political stand-up. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review the new album from bassist Michael Bizio and his quartet. And television critic David Bianculli will examine the increasing popularity of tennis on American television and the increasing amount of chatter coming from its announcers. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Ed Doherty. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistance from Deirdre Benzing and Martin Foyes. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.